Welcome to the latest episode of High Stakes. High Stakes is the podcast by K Street Capital. I'm your host, Paige Soya, Managing Director of K Street Capital, and we're on season two now. Season two is all about exits. So we're very lucky to have two incredible guests on today, Rich Leggett, longtime K Street investor, and Tom McCormick. And before we get started, why don't you guys give a couple of quick intros, a little bit of background, and share how many exits you've been involved in one form or another?
Thanks, Paige, for having us. It's great to be here again on season two. And real quick background, 33-year career, kind of broken in three segments. Started my career in consulting, management consulting, and then middle part of my career, I was an investment banker and an equity research analyst, technology sector, software and services primarily. I was a managing director at Goldman Sachs in London and in New York, both in research and investment banking, and then had an opportunity to go run a company. And I always kind of wanted to go run a company. And over the last 17 years up until the end of 2021, ran three different companies. All were private equity backed, all happened to be turnarounds. The first one I didn't know was a turnaround, but the others I did. And we had two successful exits, which ultimately turned into IPOs in those cases. And we can talk a little bit about that playbook. And then also, as you mentioned, not only a longtime K Street investor, but one of the founding members of K Street. So it's been a lot of fun seeing K Street just blossom into this wonderful platform that it is today. So
thanks, Rich. Tom?
And I'm Tom McCormick. I was a corporate lawyer at Shaw Pittman, Potts and Trowbridge, now Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman, for about 26 years. And then I left to join the BF Salt Company as the president of that company. That was a conglomerate that owned at that time Chevy Chase Bank and several other companies in real estate and money management. We ended up selling Chevy Chase Bank soon before the banking crisis, in a tribute to the chairman, Frank Saul. As a corporate lawyer, I'd managed lots of acquisitions and therefore exits, both on the buying side and the selling side of both public companies and private companies. Was a counselor to many of the entrepreneurs who decided at one point or another to sell their companies. Since I met Rich, I was involved in a company that he'll refer to here as the controlling shareholder, which we eventually decided to exit that company in a successful exit.
So, Tom, it sounds like we might want to do a separate episode just on your other exit experiences here. But for now, I guess maybe we focus on the Frontier exit, which I know a lot of these tales, but it would be, I think, really great for our audience to hear just the background on that. Rich, and maybe we can dig in on some of the points.
Yeah. So we exited Frontier. We sold the company in November of 2021. A little bit of background on Frontier. It's a global market intelligence business. So it's a SaaS-based business kind of focused on information services related to economic and political intelligence around the world. And our clients were large corporates, primarily, almost exclusively, across a number of sectors, healthcare, not in financial services, interesting enough, healthcare, consumer goods, and B2B kind of big industrial companies. And so there's a whole story about how Tom became involved, and we essentially spun Frontier View out from a larger company that we had combined Frontier View with another company. And we were actually in the process of an exit with Frontier when the pandemic hit, and then that kind of put everything on hold. And we were 3 weeks away from kind of getting a deal done when the pandemic kind of made everybody go pencils down. And we went from kind of thinking we were on the path to exit to trying to figure out survival. And that was a bit of a scary moment. And our private equity backer kind of went to all of its portfolio companies and basically said, you're all in the same boat. We don't know what's going to happen. And so you got to make whatever you have last as long as possible. We're not sure we're going to be able to kind of, you know, everyone's going to need resources, and we're not sure we're going to be able to do that. So our starting point is figure it out on your own, and then, you know, we'll go from there. In that process, one of the bidders came back and offered a fire sale price for the company. And, you know, at that moment of time, which was probably the peak of uncertainty and panic, kind of think end of
like
March,
early,
I think March, early April, when it looked like everything had stopped and the world was going to come to an end. And somebody came in, and you know, they came back with a kind of a fire sale offer. And the private equity firm and other members of the board, I think, were very interested in, you know, kind of just pursuing that as an option. And I wasn't. And so, like, I think a lot of entrepreneurs, you know, you always want to kind of think through other options. And fortunately, you know, I've known Tom for a number of years, actually through another venture where I first met him, where I was on the other side of negotiating with Tom, which is no fun, by the way, and, you know, explained to Tom what was going on. And Tom kind of came in as our guardian angel. And we went back to our board and offered to basically, I mean, Tom can tell the story, but basically offered to capitalize the company and have basically spin the company out. Tom would provide the capital and Tom would become the controlling shareholder. The private equity firm would still own a stake in the company. And Tom's two requirements were that he was the controlling shareholder and that the employees collectively owned more than either one of those shareholders, Tom, or the private equity firm, as kind of the outcome of the transaction. And we did that in 9 days in the middle of all this panic. So it was an incredible moment for all of us in the company. And I think it speaks a lot to, you know, Tom and Tom's character and spirit of understanding from all of his experiences, I think, you know, what would motivate the team and also hopefully create a great outcome for him. So that's a little bit of the backstory. And then we can talk a little bit about the exit. But Tom, I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that.
No, that's a good rendition.
Yeah. So then we're happily, from almost literally, you know, from that moment on, we started.
Actually, and hold on, let's back up a second, because I want to remind everyone, I don't think everyone knows this story. Like, how do you and Tom know each other?
So I own an ice cream business on the eastern shore of Maryland called the Scottish Highland Creamery. And I bought that 6 years ago. And I bought it from a couple that had started the business and it turned into this cult following, kind of wildly successful business on the eastern shore. Small, but very big following. And they were going to sell the business and their transaction kind of went awry. And I had heard about it and wanted to buy the business. And I reached out to the founders and they said, we're not negotiating with anybody anymore. You've got to deal with this guy, Tom. So they gave me Tom's number and I called him and that's how I got to meet Tom. And he is a very tough negotiator when he's on the other side. But we know each other and he became my unofficial, or I guess official board of directors of one in the ice cream business and has just been a wonderful mentor and advisor throughout. So it was very helpful, I think, when this happened to be able to do this transaction in 9 days. Tom amazingly, you know, felt comfortable enough with, I guess, with me and just the nature of our business to be willing to commit significant capital to allow us to spin out and you know, become independent and do what we wanted to do.
And to get the whole thing done in 9 days. I mean, I remember when this was all transpiring and just thinking how amazing it was, but it's very fortunate, I guess, that you guys had met through this other interesting transaction a few years before.
What really enabled it to happen quickly is that there was very limited due diligence and a short list of advisors on the transaction. Because I knew Rich and was introduced to his team, I had decided that both because it was a people business, which I sort of understood, having managed a law firm for a long time. And I believe that Rich was a very good and honest and straightforward and ambitious and caring business person. I really decided to make the investment based on him and my understanding of the business through him. And as the private equity people say, well, who's going to be your tax people and your accounting people and your lawyers and your investment banker? I said, that's me. Been in all those roles at various points in my career. So I can decide everything and decide it quickly.
Well, that speeds things up.
That's the way we proceed.
Well, and I think what was also really powerful about all that, Paige, was the message it sent to the team too, because this was a scary time. And actually most of the team, the senior team, was aware of the prior transaction. And so, you know, I think when it fell through, but they weren't aware of the fire sale opportunity. Only I was aware of that. And so when Tom was able to come in and send that kind of a message to the senior team and quite frankly, to everybody in the company who was, you know, very nervous about what was going to happen just generally, because if you go back in time, then, you know, it just seemed like, gosh, am I going to have a job tomorrow and can I get paid and that sort of thing. It was a very strong message to everybody and it allowed everyone to not be distracted and just focus. And it allowed us also to do some things that we weren't able to do under our prior construct. So we broke a lot of glass and reinvented ourselves very quickly as well. So in a way, as scary as the time was, it was probably the most fulfilling and exciting time in my professional career, because we could just go for it and we felt excited about that.
it's really cool, especially after you thought you were getting, you were having an exit, and then that turned on its head, and then it ended.
And it went completely opposite, where it's like, you know, I was so frustrated because the willingness to consider like selling the business in a fire sale, just because there was some uncertainty, just seems so wrong as well. Given, you know, when you put, I don't know, at that point, 9.5 years of my life into something, and then, you know, just kind of knee-jerk reactions, it just felt very frustrating. So
exactly. So I didn't mean to interrupt you by all of that, but go on with the rest of how the actual happened.
So we were kind of happily, so from that moment on, almost like within a month, we started, the business kind of started growing, and we grew every single quarter, and we were just, we were having a lot of fun, and we were kind of moving along. And meanwhile, at that time in the external markets, you saw kind of multiples really expanding, right? Like you saw SaaS multiples going up into the mid-teens as well. So we had this kind of frothy market, and we were having great success and really enjoying it. And we started to get some unsolicited inbounds. And so, we talked about them internally, which we'll first talk about them with Tom and then talked about them internally. And Tom wasn't in any, I don't want to put words in your mouth, Tom, but I think you weren't in any rush to sell. We were just getting going. But at the same time, with some inbounds and also recognizing, and one of the things I kind of over the years have learned is you need a lot of planets to align properly, actually, for an exit to be a good exit, in terms of valuation, in terms of roles for people. And I started to see some of those planets aligning in terms of the external market conditions. You've got a few different types of inquiries coming in. And, so we thought about all of these, and then, can you create any kind of, potential competitive tension there? And is it the time to sell? And I think one of the things that was important in that, besides Tom's, Tom was gracious and said kind of, there's no pressure from me to sell. A lot of the team had been with the company for a long time. I had been there 11 years. There were almost every member of my senior team had been there longer than me, and they never had any kind of an outcome, right? They put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. So the fact that we were all of a sudden kind of in the flow of a few conversations, that we very much included them in all of the evaluations and thinking through that, I think was attractive to a lot of folks. So, one of the things that I also said to the team is I'm not going to make this decision in a vacuum. It's really up to you guys. Say, like, what do you want to do? But we had enough interest that it made sense to start to think about that. And then when we ultimately sold, we had first said no to this particular buyer because of the type of deal structure that they had come to. It was a nice headline number, but it wasn't kind of a mix of consideration that we were interested in. So then they came back having raised some capital, and they offered us and kind of hit the bid, I guess, and in the structure we wanted. And so as we went back as a team, kind of that made sense to everybody to decide to do that at that point.
And that was in 2022, right?
It was November 2021.
November 2021. Perfect
timing. Which was really kind of truly, if you look at multiples, it was kind of peak multiples as well. And that was a consideration we talked about. So gosh, we don't know how long this is going to last, especially for the nature of our business. A lot of our business was very focused on helping big companies understand the macro environment. We're like, God, we've never been more relevant in what we do. Multiples have never higher, and we have people interested in us. Should we think about this? Because if we miss this window, we might not get another window like this for a while. And if things slow down, that might get tougher. So it was, we weren't in a rush to sell. We wasn't even in the fabric of our thinking at the time. But again, when you start to see some of those planets align, it'd be imprudent not to focus on it a little bit.
And I guess at that time, Tom, you were the controlling stakeholder, right? So I imagine maybe Rich, after you and your team decided like this is something we want to do, then that conversation happened with Tom?
No, it was first with Tom, I think.
First with Tom.
Yeah, it was really first between Rich and myself about whether an exit at that time was appropriate. And then we went out to the senior management team to get their input. And really, this case presented the classic tension, I think, between the two fundamental considerations of an exit, which is, no matter who the entrepreneur is, no matter how valuable they think they are, no matter how critical they think they might be to the combined company, they almost never are.
Yeah.
And yet, if they enjoy where they are and what they're doing, like this team did, it's a tough choice between Do you want to stay in an environment that you really like, where you are thriving, where you expect the next couple of years will not necessarily, but likely to continue to improve and grow the business? Or do you want to cash in now and take the certainty of the consideration and the uncertainty in how your career will go forward from here on? And when we had probably, Rich, what, 3 or 4 serious conversations at various stages of certainty on the deal, and the team to a person was anywhere from 55-45 to 60-40. Everybody had both considerations of, do they want to take the money and change their career path or keep on their career path with the uncertainty of whether they have a big payoff down the road, as Rich said, when the stars continue to align or realign in another way. Ultimately, it was a tough decision for them. They decided to proceed with a transaction because the stars were very much aligned. And it was a choice, as I told them, and if you don't do this, you probably need to consider that we're going to stay in this business and hope to grow it and become more valuable over a 3 to 5 year time span.
Exactly.
So it isn't going to do this 6 months from now or 12 months from now. You're going to be in it for the medium term. And I was happy either way. It's a great business, great team, had a great product. I was confident in our ability to continue to grow the value of the business. At the same time, I understood that they might want to do differently, and I was making a terrific return. So it was...
I was happy either way too. And, you know, but I did make it clear in the conversations with the team, because I've been through this once before. So we had an exit. I made it pretty clear to the team that I would help get the company integrated, but that I would be stepping away at some point down the road, because I've just known. And also, I think once you've been a CEO, it's hard, you know, it's hard to give up being the CEO, even if you have a great role in the new company. And the company that acquired us, you know, I think it did offer some of that, but I just kind of knew long term that it would be different. I'd actually lived that experience once before. So I that's why I kind of said, I don't want this to be a decision about me. I want it to be kind of what the group wants to do. And I'm happy to go either way as well, because we have finally a wonderfully supportive investor. We're doing well in the business. We all work well together. It was a pretty special situation. And having the benefit of experience, you know that those things don't happen by accident, and they don't happen often. And I think the team kind of understood that too. But at the same time, we changed a lot of lives. And I think that, you know, not only on our team, but we changed a lot of lives, because with a lot of what Tom realized from the result, he did a lot of very interesting things charitably. So, you know, it was a wonderful feeling for everyone.
That's great. Do you feel like everyone, when it was all said and done, you know, Tom as a large stakeholder, Rich, you as sort of the founder, and the management team, everyone was pretty happy with the outcome?
In the beginning, yeah.
Yeah. At the time of transaction.
At the time of transaction, 100%. And, you know, quite honestly, like the entire company. So, you know, one of the things we did as part of the spin out and the recap was, we didn't hold the ownership just amongst the small number of people. We spread it, you know, throughout everybody in the company. So I think everybody found, like, all of a sudden there was this exciting event that happened, all of their hard work, they were able to kind of realize some value. They still had no one lost a job. Everybody still had their role, and they joined this bigger company. And, you know, at least on the surface, it felt like that was a great fit for us. We were filling an important part of their strategy. It was a very tech forward company. A lot of the same stated shared values and culture. It was a global business. So I think there was a lot of excitement amongst the team also to see that what we had built now could be part of something bigger that was exciting. And also that company was gearing up for its own public offering. So, you know, that's always an exciting process too. I've run that playbook before.
Yeah. So I wonder, maybe does it make sense to talk about the post exit through IPO story and then step back and talk about some of the things you wish you had done differently or things that went differently than you expected, I guess.
Sure. We kind of knew the IPO was going to happen. We sold in November of 21. We knew the IPO would happen sometime in the middle of 2022. So one of the things I think that was important for us in selling the company as part of the deal is that we absolutely wanted to make sure there was an earnout. So we should talk about kind of deal structure. Neither Tom or I really wanted an earnout. We don't like earnouts. We think they actually, having been on both sides of transactions, rarely work in terms of achieving some of the shared goals that you might have when you acquire a company in terms of integration and that sort of thing. But they insisted that they wanted to have part of the deal being an earnout. So as part of that, we sort of said, okay, that's fine, but we also want to therefore make sure that our business plan is funded as presented so that we have the ability to hit the earnout. Like the earnout was based on our plan, and therefore that plan required, you know, some investment and some resources, and it was all very clearly laid out. And we had gotten their sort of verbal commitment to do that. And so that was exciting for all of us as well, because it's kind of like, okay, you're going to be part of this thing, but you're, you know, we can still be ring fenced to go off and do what we did and be able to do it and maybe even be helped along because of some of the potential synergy that would come along with it. But like many situations, this company that acquired us happened to have made a number of acquisitions themselves as well. So, you know, I think when you have a lot of competing priorities and maybe not every part of the business thriving, it creates pressure to change the game a little bit. And that kind of happened, I would say, in the early part of about 4 or 5 months after we did the deal. And that created, you know, the first kind of friction point, because now it's like we started to have to compromise certain trade-offs, and that put the earnout in jeopardy. But it also kind of started to create some competing priorities in terms of a focus and that sort of thing. And that, you know, was something we were trying to avoid preemptively, but we couldn't do that. So that created some challenge for us. And ultimately, I think, create a lot of friction and frustration amongst the team.
And maybe talk a little bit about deal structuring and like some of the things that I think, I mean, having been involved in a number of exits myself, I think the things that people don't think about in terms of working capital pegs and that sort of thing. Maybe.
Well, in SaaS businesses especially, there's some gotchas that I've learned, and Tom probably know a bunch more. But the first one is you hit it perfectly, Paige, the working capital question. So, you know, SaaS businesses by definition have large amounts of deferred revenue. And so how do they get treated? Do they get treated in the working capital calculation, or do they get excluded from it? And the buyer always wants it to be included, and the seller wants it to be excluded, because it usually is a pretty big number and it can dramatically change the consideration if you have to make the adjustment. So I think that one is always a point of contention and negotiation and always tricky. Ultimately, I think we tried to come up with a creative solution to that. I don't remember exactly what it was, Tom, but I don't think it wasn't the exact traditional calculation either way. We found some, I don't know if you recall how we did that. I just remember we came up with our own formula that we felt like was a reasonable compromise that they accepted.
Yeah. Essentially, we negotiated for a cash payout, a cash dividend, if you will, out of Frontier, the target company, of what we thought was the excess capital. Mm-hmm. And had a long business discussion about what the true excess capital was. And that was really, we had to come up with our own formula for how you would look at a balance sheet and adjust it appropriately in order for us to get the significant part of the consideration. It was probably 10% of the value of the enterprise we took out as a special payment, if you will, of what believed to be the excess working capital, given that we had deferred revenue on the books.
Yeah. So that worked pretty well. Another big consideration is around escrows, and specifically, I always, you know, in SaaS businesses, sales tax liability or potential tax liabilities. And I got burned on this one, which is an interesting side story. My first exit, was a number of years ago. It was 2007, I think, 2008. And we were owned by a big private equity firm, and we sold the company for a really nice outcome. And the buyer put 10% of the deal in escrow, and the private equity firm convinced me that escrow should only come from the employee part of the transaction, not from their part of the transaction. And their logic was that there's no way an employer will go after its employees on that escrow, but they will definitely go after the big bad private equity firm. So the private equity firm didn't have any share of the escrow, and it was just in the employees. And on the 364th day of the escrow, so one day from being released, the company informed us that it was taking the entire escrow, and that there was, you know, they felt there was a sales tax liability. And at the time, there was a lot of gray area around how information services were treated for sales tax nexus purposes. And certain states were very aggressive. One in particular was New York. And interestingly, the company that bought us had an exemption from sales tax. So theoretically, we would have fallen under that exemption, but they decided that there was a liability and they were going to take 10% out of the pockets of their employees. Needless to say, that didn't generate a lot of goodwill. But that was a very important lesson around kind of making sure you have your ducks in order with regards to sales tax.
So that was I think people would be surprised, maybe not you two, but just to learn that it's more often than you would expect that 10% escrow doesn't end up getting paid. For one reason or another. You always think, oh, of course, that's going to get paid. Like, what possible reason could there be? And then there always is.
I think earnouts, I'm not a huge fan of the earnout. We talked about that already. And I guess if there is going to be an earnout, then I think what I would have done differently in this transaction is gotten some sort of written assurance that we would have been protected during the earnout period with our business plan funded. And that if they broke that covenant, then we would just have gotten the earnout anyway. Or so there'd be some sort of teeth in it. We kind of took it on, kind of
good faith.
Good faith. And that wasn't what happened. So that was a bit frustrating as well.
We tried to bend that up. First, what we did structure-wise is make the earnout a very small portion of the total consideration. It was really a thin layer of icing on the very big cake, because having been on both sides of earnouts, they never work. Never. And while folks like Rich can believe we could have put teeth in it, there's no teeth you can put into an earnout that can withstand the necessity of the acquiring company to have some flexibility. And the acquiring company always argues, appropriately in my view, that we have paid a lot of money to buy your company. We have to have the ability to be the ultimate decider when things might need to move around. And so you can try to put teeth into it. We tried to in this instance, but in this instance, there was a lot of other pressures on the acquiring company, and they just moved things around. So it made, and we had a earnout that was in two stages. The first stage is relatively soon. The second stage was further away. The further away it is, the more likely it is that someone's going to say, we don't really pay that money. We think we've overpaid. Some of the employees have left, and things change.
And it's a good point that we specifically did it in two stages because we wanted to make sure that at least there was a shot to hit part of it. It was icing, but it was, icing is, there's a reason icing tastes good on a cake. And so you wanted to make sure that we had a chance to get it. So we did divide it into two. So if you have to have an earnout, I would say to stagger it in some form or fashion. By the way, I want to be clear that I completely am sympathetic to the acquiring company's desire to, because of other pressures to, kind of find ways to accelerate certain things or look for synergies. So we were good corporate citizens about trying to make that work. But by doing so, by definition, you're putting, you're diluting focus and you're diluting the, the energy of the team across other things that aren't solely focused on running the business well.
Yeah. I think at K Street, we've had about 13 exits and most of those had an earnout associated with them in some way, shape, or form, both for the founders, right, and the investors, like us as the investors. So we see it. And only in one case has it ever gotten paid that I'm aware of since my time there. Only once.
Yeah. So it is a way that I think a buyer can make the headline number bigger, but still believable to the seller. And the seller, is attracted by that headline number. When the company that tried to buy us first came by, they came first with a big headline number, but they wanted it to be, I forget, Tom, I think it's like 90% stock deal or something like that, or 80% stock deal. And, and their stock was, obviously, we're pretty sophisticated folks. And, I was an analyst and a banker. Tom has done millions of deals. Like, it didn't take us more than, 15 seconds to know that stock was at an inflated valuation and that, it was uncertain if that was going to stay inflated. So we basically said, we don't want to do the deal now. We're not really for sale, so we'll be around. And, when your stock is actually, can be empirically measured in the market every day, come back and then we'll know what it's worth. And then we can work through the deal then. Or we'd rather have a deal that looks like this. And we gave them what that looked like. And we're fortunate that they came back, having raised some capital.
So is it mostly cash, more cash than equity structure?
All cash.
all cash. Yeah. Even better.
A little bit of equity, but only for the employees, not for Tom.
Yeah. One PS about earnouts, to not be too dogmatic about it. Earnouts can be appropriate if there's a valuation difference that's based on some external event that has yet to occur. I mean, for example, you have terrific intellectual property, you have a patent pending. If the patent is fully granted, which everybody may expect is going to happen but hasn't happened yet, then you can have a subsequent payment when the patent is ultimately granted. But when it's based on operational results, particularly if they're more than 3-4 months away, then that's a recipe for friction.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Can I share two things about deals that I don't think are obvious and I don't think most people would think about? And I've kind of learned it, if that's okay.
Yeah, please.
So one is that I think it's a very healthy process as an owner of a company to go through the process of thinking about positioning your company for sale. So one of the great experiences we had in the first part of this process that got kind of shut down because of COVID was actually going through the process of preparing the company to be sold and the positioning and the story of the company. And if you did that kind of every few years to make sure that the company you're running is the story you want to tell is the company that you're running, that you're set, you know, you're doing what you say and you're saying what you do. It's a really good process because sometimes I think you drift a little bit from that. And it sort of forces you to come back and maybe reset your vision, maybe think a little more bold and aggressively, and then start to make sure the company's running against that. So I think that process is a good process as a management team to go through. Probably not every year, but maybe every few years, just like, okay, let's pretend we're going to go sell the company. What does that look like? And what does the next 3 to 5 years look like? It's kind of that long-term planning, but with the exit storyline in mind. So I think that was one thing that I think is something I would recommend. The other is to make sure that you have your information. You know, if you imagine like what a table of contents of a data room looks like, make sure all of those things that you're keeping that infrastructure accurate and current at all times.
Yeah.
Like one thing that I've learned over the years, and I say this all the time, my sales team got so sick of hearing this, but time kills deals. And I think if you get a large due diligence request list and you're not getting, and you don't have that information ready, and you've got to now go spend, you know, a month and a half trying to pull it together, things can happen. The world changes. Another deal comes across the company's desk and that becomes more important. It's maybe a bigger needle mover, whatever it is. So having your infrastructure kind of there, your KPIs, all of your contracts kind of properly indexed, all of whatever the information you might get in a data room request or a data request, I think is very interesting and important to have. The buyer in our case gave us a list. I think it was 220 items long, and we had it back to them in 4 days. And I think they were blown
away. Wow.
I think
That's
they
amazing.
Had no idea that we were going to have it back to them in 4 days. And, you know, I think one, that shows them that we're a well-managed company. So I think that also kind of maybe lightens the due diligence effort on their part and our part. But secondly, you know, it did not allow time to creep in as a potential deal killer down the road.
I mean, even when we make investments in companies, if they can't get things to us quickly and accurately, it's right. always a flag in my mind, like, how organized is this company? What kind of messes are there that I don't even know about? Like, now I need to pay more attention to it. And yeah.
And we're doing it at Case Street, it's much earlier stage. Like, you know, when you're a company that's a bit more mature, it's like, you know, that is a huge red flag. It's like, you can't get your model. Like, what? Like,
As a person who's done many deals, I would underline that completely. No one should even think about selling until they've got everything they think a buyer would want ready to be tipped over immediately, and then to be immediately responsive to any question, because time is critical for every possible reason.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Well, let's see. I think we're coming up on time here, but I want to make sure. I was going to ask you, did you build the company with the exit in mind, Rich? But it sounds like you kind of, I mean, it was private equity backed when you got to it, right? So you knew there was going to be an exit, or they were expecting an exit at some point. So you always sort of had that mindset, I guess, right?
I did and I didn't. Like in the sense of, there's an old saying, I think, in the case of venture and private equity, if you build a company specifically for exit, be prepared to own it for a long time. And so I tried to... I knew that there's always a time clock, right, when you're private equity backed, and both of the exits that I've had. And so, and both were turnarounds, right? And so I needed a path and a plan for the turnaround. But, you know, I think at the same time, you want to do things, and this might be good or bad quality, but I always want to do things in the highest quality way too. So it was, you know, there was no sort of, well, cutting corners to make something more attractive for exit. It was like, let's just do the right thing. First of all, for our clients, second of all, for our people. And if we build something of high quality, it'll be worth something and we'll have lots of optionality for exit. So, you know, yes, exit was always kind of in the mindset, but I also wanted to make sure we were building something that had, you know, had a strong durability.
So two last topics I wanted to cover. One is, are there any illusions of value that you would share that, like, you thought, oh, the company's going to be worth a lot because of XYZ, but then nobody actually cared about that in the end, or it didn't matter as much as you imagined it would?
Yeah. I think there's always illusions of value. I think the more experienced you get more realistic about value. And having seen a number of different cycles, you know, I think value is created out of, you know, lots of factors. So I think I probably today have less illusions of value and more appreciation, and also trying to educate the team. I'll give you a sense. When I got to Frontier, and again, this is a company that was in decline and needed a turnaround, there was a famous slide that one of the founders that, you know, I was coming in to replace and put up, that, you know, it was called the road to $1 billion. They wanted the business to be worth $1 billion, which of course anybody who starts in a company wants to feel like they're part of a company that could be worth $1 billion. But like, we weren't worth $20 million yet. So it's like, I kind of think the road has to have different mile markers, and you can model anything. But I also think, you know, trying to educate people on sort of what drives value is far more important than just making a big number of illusions of value. So if you educate people on the drivers of value for whatever your sector is, and then you run your company around those value drivers, you can start to then build instead of an illusion of value, you know, real tangible value, and show people the path to what that looks like. So for example, we started to teach everybody down to the most junior account manager that every dollar of ARR could be multiplied by whatever the multiple was. And that if we lost a client, you know, how much value we destroyed. And when we gained a client, how much value we gained. And we would share that information with them. And just getting everybody thinking that way starts to create the building blocks of value. And not every company has always done that down to, you know, the most junior people, which in many cases are at the front line of defending value or, you know, creating that.
So exactly. Yeah.
Realistically, every acquirer is only going to acquire a company if they have a common sense of what's creating value. If you have to try to educate somebody about why there's value here and what the metrics of value measurement are, they're not going to acquire your company at a fair price. You need to have somebody who appreciates the metrics that you are using to value the company.
That's a really good point.
Having said that, every business owner, public or private, believes that they're worth more than they are, because by definition, and if they're a founder or entrepreneur, the reason they are successful up to that point of having a company to sell is because they see the path to success. Whereas an acquiring company says, what are all the problems I might have when I acquire this company? So there's always going to be a 20-25% difference between the roads are always going up, and the acquirer saying, yeah, but the roads might be bumpy and have a little bit of dips in them no matter what, because that's the way life is.
And I think sometimes that creates a trap sometimes for entrepreneurs. And we see it a lot, Paige, in some of the earlier stage companies, because obviously they're going to think that they're worth a lot more. And if you raise money at too high of a valuation and you set yourself up to have to deliver with no margin of error in order to live up to that valuation, it creates a lot of challenges in its company. So it's different stages of the process. It's valuation really is an important consideration in different ways.
Yeah, exactly. So last thing I was going to ask you is just, so you, after the exit happened, you stayed on for a while, like about a year, I want to say, and took the company public, stayed on for a little bit after that, and then left. And so I guess the question is, were you ready to transition at the time when you left? And did you have a succession plan in place? And how did that all play out?
So yeah, I, I was ready to transition out, you know, and again, I've been very transparent with my team that that was something that was going to happen. So they weren't surprised about it. So it was a little different than I think if I was like just stepping down in a company and making sure we had true succession planning in place. Like if I was going to step back and we were still independent and making sure there was a CEO in waiting. Because the, you know, when you sell, we sold to another company, there was already a, you know, there was a CEO and a president of the company and that sort of thing. I didn't need to worry about that. I just needed to make sure that each function was set up for success, you know, without my being there. And also I was given a little more responsibility within the company that acquired. So I was very helpful in recruiting my successor, both with an outside option and also, you know, suggesting somebody from within, so that I was very involved in the interview process and sharing my thoughts on that. So I think we tried to do that to the best you can in terms of handicapping it with the team, but also making sure that each of the functions that we had, you know, all of the leaders around my table in our company, they were very well set up to continue on and do it. They just didn't have me as the, you know, as the person kind of directing traffic, I guess. But yeah. Having said all that, I don't think it ultimately turned out very well, but that's probably a topic for
another guest. A part two episode. Awesome. Well, thank you guys so much for doing this. I think it's super interesting to hear the story, especially having you here, Tom, too, from your perspective, going through the whole thing. And I think there will be a lot of value for our audience just hearing some of these lessons. In fact, so many lessons that I'm probably going to make it a two-part episode already without a second recording. But that's it. Any final thoughts or anything else you want to share?
I'll add one postscript. The private equity firm that had owned the company that was willing to step aside, although they still had an equity stake in it, was stunned at the price we got for the deal.
I was going to ask that, because what was the what was the multiple on what the fire sale price was and what you ultimately sold the company for?
Oh my gosh, probably 20x.
Wow. And that was over a 2-year period, right?
And let's put it this way. They were able to pay off all the debt that they had burned our old company with and recapitalize the balance sheet. And so that was, they were stung by it as well.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Really good point, Tom. Cool. Well, thank you guys both for being here. That's a wrap.
Thank you, Paige.
Thanks for having us.
And that's a wrap for today's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed it, please leave us a rating and review. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. Thanks.